Hi everyone, welcome to The Grief Coach. This is your host, Brooke James. At the top of this episode, I wanted to do a quick content warning. Today's episode talks about abuse, alcoholism, addiction, and suicide. If any of those topics don't work for you, you might want to skip this episode. With that said, it is a really honest conversation, and I am so grateful to my friend Amy for sharing her experience with us. So with that, let's get into it.
Today, we have with us Amy Santee. She is a Portland-based career coach for user experience and design professionals. Amy, thank you so much for being here today.
Hello, Brooke. I'm so excited.
Me too. So for the audience, Amy and I met because we are in a program together at NYU, and we were partners our first semester and hit it off and now fast friends. I was sharing about the podcast, and Amy is going to share her story with us today. So Amy, thank you for being here. If you want to introduce yourself and share your grief story.
Yeah, I'm Amy Santee. My mom, Karen, passed away in 2017. She was living in Michigan and I was living here in Portland. I wasn't living in the same place as her. And in fact, I wasn't really seeing her that much, but you know, we stayed in touch. We had a fairly decent relationship over the phone and we would visit each other every now and then. But my mom, her death is kind of interesting. It goes back many, many years to origins in her teen years with alcohol consumption. And just something, you know, that's something she continued to do over time, over many decades, developing an alcohol addiction that eventually was a big part of her death. What drove the nail in the coffin, as they say, is her husband committing suicide the year before she passed away. And they were having lots of stress and problems in their life, in their marriage, in their social circle, and the stress of my mom's alcoholism on the relationship basically caused, contributed to her husband killing himself by shooting himself in the head with a gun, kind of out of nowhere. I never had the sense that he would do something like that. I didn't really know his mental state. I knew they were having problems and he had called me once about it, but I never imagined or I never foresaw that sort of thing taking place. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, my mom was by herself. She didn't have friends in town. Again, I mentioned they were having just weird things going on in their social circle. And I think my mom's husband, Chris, and their friends kind of realizing the extent alcohol addiction, turning a lot of people off from spending time with them. And so she became alone, even more alone, living on, you know, a half acre of property, kind of in a rural area of Michigan. And again, I didn't live there. No one in our family lived nearby her. So she mm-hmm. was physically and emotionally alone. Something that will help with understanding this is our relationship was never very good. My mom being an alcoholic, and people with alcoholic parents will know this, is that that can put a huge strain on relationships with children and parents. She was always very emotionally and physically abusive to me and my brother. And over time, as I got into my college years and then into my adult career years, we started to try and mend some of those fissures in our relationship, but there wasn't much that could really be done because the fundamental issues had never been addressed and she remained addicted to alcohol. Mm-hmm. And so the cause of the strife in our relationship and the poor quality of our relationship was still there. And, you know, visited each other. She came out to Portland. I visited her in Michigan. We definitely had some good times. We went to Wisconsin a few years before she passed away to celebrate Thanksgiving. Actually, two times. One was right after her husband died too. And that was a very strange and sad experience. But that was probably the biggest challenge of all of this, is that we never had a very good relationship. We started to try to get closer, but she didn't put the effort in that she needed to in order to, you know, do her part and, you know, apologize for the past and acknowledge what had been done. At the same time, I tried to set certain things aside in order to support her as much as I could. Mm-hmm. But as she was getting sicker, as she began to just drink more and more and more after her husband killed himself. Obviously, it was getting worse, and she began to develop a brain disease that is essentially what caused her to, we believe, have a heart attack. We don't know for sure what in the moment actually killed her, but all of it kind of culminated in that particular moment. So from afar, you know, I'm in the Pacific Northwest, she's in the Midwest. I try to stay in touch with her, support her, but over that period of time, I came to realize and kind of learn the lesson of having to protect myself also in that time. Imagine having a parent who treats you really poorly your whole life and then needs your help at the end, and you really want to try and help them, but they're not really, you can't help them. You like have only, you've done as much as you possibly can, and you have to not only mourn their dying, but you have to mourn their death when it happens. And even before that, you're mourning the loss of the relationship that you were never able to achieve with that person.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, and would love yes. to go into a little bit more detail. But if you can first talk with us about what it's like, and I'm sure that people listening have experienced this as well, of you're watching someone and you hope they get better, and you're doing what you can. Like, we can talk about setting boundaries after this, but mm-hmm. What was it like to be trying to help and wanting her to get better, and she wasn't?
Yeah, I mean, you always want your parent to stop doing harmful things that are harmful to them and to you, right, your whole mm-hmm. life. And then eventually you become an adult and you realize that this person has a problem that you cannot solve for them. So that was something I have had so much practice in. But once you actually start to see that thing affect them, as in it is literally killing them, because you can be an alcoholic for your whole life. Yeah, it's probably harming your health. But is it can you look at a person and see that they're actually literally dying because of it? That's not always the case. And so that's what happened here. Was my mom's husband, Chris, committed suicide. That was kind of like the last straw in terms of any, I think, ability that she had to come back from this alcohol addiction and do something differently. And she made a series of choices in her life that led to this. But I strongly believe that up to that point, she still had the ability and the agency to stop drinking. But when her husband killed himself, I think that agency kind of slipped away. I don't think that was something that was graspable anymore by her or by anyone in that situation, where you become just totally consumed with grief and you're trying to feel better about the loss of your spouse, who he was only 48 or 49. He was like a young guy. My mom was 53, I think, when he passed away. So they were young, you know, they had moved up to Michigan together after getting married in, I want to say, 2011. So, you know, they had a solid relationship for quite a while. And so to lose something like that and to feel like it was your fault, mm-hmm. I totally understand why this happened to my mom, because it's unlikely that someone in that situation with that strong of an addiction could escape something like that without having the social support, and the family support, and the support of her husband. So like all of those things just evaporated. And we know that social support is something that helps people with alcohol addiction. It helps people with suicide. And even though the medical reports does not state my mom killed herself, I really do believe that she killed herself in a way. I believe that she had a biological reaction to her alcoholism, developed a brain disease, and then had a heart attack. So it was biological causes. But I also believe that she killed herself in the sense of knowing what she was doing towards the end, kind of knowing the direction that it was going in. And so, like I said, I wasn't there with her for the most part, but when her husband killed himself, I definitely flew out there to support her. My family from Wisconsin went out. We were with her. We figured out everything with regard to the funeral and cremation and all of that stuff. But it was a very stressful time, because my mom's husband's family blamed my mom for her husband killing himself. And that is not, that's not the reality. People don't cause other people to kill themselves. Situations and circumstances cause people to kill themselves, to make that choice. And it's not a, oh, I'm just going to go kill myself today. It's a thing that happens in a very fraught situation, but there is still a decision made there, even though that person is not in their right mind, as we would say, to make a decision like that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting aspect to this, because I do not believe that Chris's suicide was her fault, but I totally 100% believe that the circumstances of having a marriage and social situation that was plagued by my mom's alcoholism was a key factor in what occurred, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, we go out and visit, we have to leave her at some point. And, you know, there's only so much you can do from afar. My aunt was really awesome. My mom's sister called my mom every day, called her multiple times a day. And my aunt is a caring kind of person that way, and is that way with other family members as well. But my interactions were a bit more limited again because of all this baggage from the past, right? I am continuing to have to do things for a person who never really did things for me, mm-hmm. right? And I'm happy to talk about anything regarding our relationship and how that looked, but I suppose there are, you know, different levels. Like maybe your parents are somewhat abusive, maybe they, you know, treat you poorly or whatever, but there can be extremes for that, you know. And so seeing my mom in this state was challenging to me, because I had to make a decision at a certain point for myself to, like you said, put a boundary in place to protect myself from my mom essentially doing additional harm to me in a way through her behaviors and actions, and through continuing to need me in a way that really was not, it wasn't reciprocated when I was a kid, right? I think this would have looked a lot different if we had kind of a typical parent-child relationship that has its normal sort of struggles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Two things. It sounds like the experience after your mom's husband died by suicide, that his family did something very like normal, that you want answers. And so you look to the simplest answer because you're devastated. And that's something I think we like when someone has lung cancer, you're like, well, how often did they smoke and how much? We want answers. And so I think this is like a larger cultural issue, excuse me, that like people disregard nuance for hard situations because mm-hmm. it's hard and you don't really want to unpack it all the time and you want the simplest answer. And so that makes sense. But the boundary piece is so important. And I think a lot of people who are listening can probably relate to this, of when you're grieving, you need to set boundaries, because if you don't, you're going to be exhausted. But just generally in relationships, that's something that's really difficult. And I really commend you for being able to do that, because a lot of people can't. And it's something I'm working on, that is just like your relationship with yourself is the most important. So how do you preserve that?
So I think, you know, I've been seeing the same therapist for 8 years. Her name is Melinda, and she knows me really, really well. And I started seeing her in 2013, actually. And my mom died in 2017. So there was a period of 4 years where I'm sure my mom came up numerous times. Our relationship mm-hmm. and how I was treated when I was a child came up numerous times, but then it shifted into full gear in the last, you know, year or so there, where I think my therapist was helping me start to process and mourn and process some grief I was having before she died. Let's say she had never died of this cause and everything was totally fine in her life other than alcoholism. I have spent years grieving a relationship that I never had with my mom. Like, it could have been this way when I was a kid, you know, and you can't go back and change that stuff. But once you start to see that your parent is possibly going to not come back from something like this, then you're like, oh shit, wow, like this is going to end soon and I have no chance, I have no opportunity to have that thing. Anyone who experiences a loss will think about that, like, oh, I'm not going to have the chance to be with this person anymore. But I think it added another dimension to it, the fact that our relationship just could have been way better than it was.
And the thing with an early death is it robs you not only of experiences that you expect you're going to be able to have, but also being able to have discussions and work things out. And as humans, we want answers, and to not be able to do that is devastating.
Yeah, really, it really is. I mean, I would have loved to continue to try to work through things and give her the chance. I was being graceful with her to give her the opportunity to change, to do things differently. But I think this goes back to what I was saying about once you go past a certain threshold, human beings with alcoholism become less and less capable, I think, of fixing that situation. You dig such a deep hole that your ladder doesn't reach to the top at a certain point. Like the ladder you could use to climb out of that hole becomes shorter than the hole itself, I guess.
Yeah.
And so that's really what made it tough. The interesting thing though is this whole time I think I had it in the back of my mind that, oh, this is a really serious thing and this could possibly kill my mom. But I don't think I ever fully believed that, because of course I didn't want it to happen. 5 years ago, I would never have thought like, oh, my mom's going to die from alcoholism. It was such a prevalent, normal kind of thing. And she was functional.
Right.
So I didn't believe that could occur. But when her husband died, that's when I realized just how dysfunctional she was. I didn't really know, because I wasn't there. I didn't see her every day. Her husband didn't really say anything to me about it until the end of his life, where he, you know, called me or he would text me and he would let me know that things were just really out of hand. I also visited them in 2016 or perhaps the end of 2015, and I did start to see it a little bit more for myself. I remember we would jump in the car and go drive across the border from Michigan to Indiana, where booze was like way cheaper, or you could get it earlier in the day, or there weren't taxes. I don't know. There was some reason why they wanted to cross the border into Indiana to go buy handles of vodka. And that stood out to me as something is wrong with that. Something is wrong with that. Something was really wrong when my mom visited me and my partner in, I want to say, 2014 or 15 here in Portland. And she asked us if she could take our bottle of vodka or gin or what something we had in the house back to her Airbnb with her. Hey, can I grab this booze? Can we pick up some lemons and limes at the store? I want to take this back to my place. Something was very wrong with that, but it didn't quite like occur to me in the moment of how serious things actually were. And then she went away. Again, I didn't see it. So I didn't see it every day. I didn't see it constantly come up. I wasn't dealing with it firsthand. So that's kind of what made it complicated as well.
Yeah. And I think one would want to give like the benefit of the doubt of like, maybe it's not so bad all the time, because you don't want it to be so bad all the time. And addicts, like, they're good at hiding their disease or making it seem like it's not as big of a thing as it is, but like, it's a disease. And like, I think that it's so important looking back, like, of course there are signs, but in the moment you don't want it to be true. And so you're like, okay, well, maybe it isn't like this all the time. And I think that's totally like, that's what I would have done.
I don't know if I ever thought, I never thought like, oh, it's probably not as bad. I think I just was probably so used to it that I thought my mom will live the rest of her life as a functional alcoholic. That was my assumption my whole life. Again, I never thought my mom would die from her alcoholism in such a, frankly, very gruesome kind of way. I mean, the name is escaping me, but she developed a brain disease where the alcohol just kind of ate away at her brain functioning. Mm-hmm. And the last time I saw her was in April 2017. So
take your time.
I flew out there in April 2017 for a couple of reasons. One, it had been several months since her husband had passed away, and we had been trying to think of a plan for her. Get her out of Michigan, sell her house, get out of that town, which was a shitty fucking town to begin with, and I don't know why she moved there, but she was there. So my family had been trying to strategize with her, get her out of there. So a few of us went out there to have a yard sale slash estate sale kind of thing, prepare to get the house sold. You know, my mom was sort of in the process of getting her house sold as well. So we went out there to help her with a lot of that stuff, but it was also my birthday. And that was a really tough time because I could see in front of me how the state of my mom's being. She had lost her mind, basically. Mm-hmm. She was acting crazy. And I take mental health stuff very seriously and not lightly, but she was really acting crazy, basically. She would just jump in her car and leave out of nowhere. She called the cops on myself and my aunt and my grandmother and told them that we were trying to kidnap her. She would be hallucinating in the hallway, talking to no one, seeing something that wasn't there. And that is, I think that's when it hit me that my mom was not going to escape this, and that there wasn't really anything that could be done about it. And so we had the yard sale. We spent some time together. My mom always used to make a key lime pie for my birthday, and they were always really good. But the last one that she made for me was like the shittiest key lime pie I had ever had from her. It wasn't the same ingredients. It wasn't the same recipe. It was some fucking recipe, random thing that she found on the internet. And that is a clear sign that something is wrong with my mom, because she wasn't doing this really great thing that I always appreciated about her, making something for me, giving me something that I like for once, right? Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of a representative of her state of being. Towards the end of that stay, I mentioned that she called the cops on us and told them that we were trying to kidnap her. And, you know, we had to explain to the police that she was really sick and asked them to go and find her. We all went and stayed at a hotel after that. And the next day, we all needed to leave. My aunt and my grandmother never saw her again after that. And I did see her one more time. I went to her house just to say goodbye. And she invited me in, but I didn't come in. I didn't go inside her house because I was exercising that boundary mm-hmm. of not wanting to subject myself to this harmful situation that I had really been trying to practice from a distance. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really talk about that much, but what that looked like for me was realizing that this situation was extremely harmful to me psychologically for all the reasons that I've talked about. But being in a situation where you want to help someone who really needs your help, while at the same time realizing that they've never helped you in the way that they should have helped you as a parent, that they've never really reciprocated, or that they've
really failed to create the right kind of relationship so that
you helping them is coming from a place of reciprocity. Mm-hmm. I had to draw that boundary with that and protect myself, not pick up the phone constantly when my mom needed me. Even if she said she wanted to kill herself, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And I had to make a decision. And I don't see a lot of people making decisions like this, because in our society, there is a very strong culture of guilt around taking care of people. Not just guilt, obligation and culture, and that works out really well a lot of the time, but in parent-child relationships that are really fraught, I see that people still feel obligated to help this person as much as they possibly can and put themselves aside, put their life aside. And I chose not to do that. I needed to put my life at the center and protect myself from having my life stolen or sucked away from me any further by my mom, which is really, it's really sad and it's really disappointing. So that was my last moment of exercising that boundary. And I told her when I saw her at the front door, we were standing there and she invited me in and I said, no, I need to get to the airport. And at that moment, right before I left, we hugged each other for, I don't know, I'll never forget that hug. It was the longest, best hug I think we ever had. And I told her in that moment, I said, I think this is the last time I'm going to see you. And I told her that because I wanted her to know that this was really serious and that this is a result of years of issues and decisions that she had made. And I would not have changed that. That's really tough. Like if I could go back and go inside her house, I think I made the best decision for myself in that moment. And I drove away. And I knew I would never see her again. And to know that and decide not to step inside her house for 5 more minutes, that was really tough, but also really brave, I think.
I'm proud of you.
Yeah. Do people cry a lot on your podcast?
Mm-hmm. Myself included.
I feel like I'm crying a lot, which, you know, I don't like it when people apologize for crying. I think that's another issue with our culture in America is to apologize for feeling emotions. And so I'm not apologizing, but I do feel like I'm crying quite a bit.
Well, I think that definitely don't apologize for emotions because they're very important. You and I have talked about this many times. Like I cry on the podcast, I would say probably half the time. Like I've been, this has moved me and like I have tears in my eyes. But in our culture, for some reason, there's this expectation of like, you must be strong while you're going through things that are really hard.
Yeah.
And because it's not, I've talked about this in podcasts many, many times, that people kind of put this weird like statute of limitation on grief. That doesn't make any sense because anyone who's experienced a loss knows that it hits you at different times, depending on what's going on. And you can just like move into this devastation and despair and emotional wave very easily. And it doesn't happen often, but it happens like no matter how much time has gone by. And I think we as a society do ourselves a disservice to not acknowledge when things are hard. And we want everything to be so easy and to be projected as everything is easy and everyone is fine. And like, that's ridiculous. Like no one is fine. No, don't. People cry all the time. All I have to say, like, and I really appreciate you sharing all of this with me and with the audience because it's the truth and it's honest and you're not the only one who's felt this way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And like, I get messages often from people who are like, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. And none of my friends know how to talk to me about this and thanking me for being able to talk about this stuff that's really hard and giving it a platform because so many people think something must be off, that they're still upset or their friends don't know how to talk to them. So maybe they're taking it.
It's true.
Harder.
When can you? Yeah, you're right. I mean, I remember when my mom died, I would be totally upfront. Oh, hey, how are you? Oh, well, my mom just died. Not great. People don't even say stuff like that. People don't know how to respond to you. There are a couple people in my life who I was frankly shocked by their lack of response to my mom dying in such a horrific way and at such a young age of 31 to lose your mom. That was, you know, obviously really tough, but yeah, people don't really know how to respond in a way that is helpful. I don't know what it is, but yeah, we don't discuss death very well or very often in close circles in our families. I think many of us don't anyway.
Mm-hmm. I think it's true. And I do this segment on the show often of what are things that people said to you that they thought were so helpful. And you're just like, are you kidding? And I like
the it's first okay. Episode, your mom was gonna die anyway.
Right. And you're just like,
No, what? So you know what? No one actually said that to me, but like that's kind of a hyperbole of the things that people do say to you. They just don't know what to say. They state a fact and try to hope that it is helpful to you somehow. And yeah, we could do better with that.
Right. And so I'm hoping that being able to put these stories out continuously helps people who are not exposed and not experienced a loss or this kind of loss, whatever it is. Every week there's different stories because each experience is unique, that like we can all be a little more empathetic and like respectful of how other people are feeling.
Absolutely.
And so that is something that if I can change one person's reaction, like then everything on this podcast will have been worth it. Cause so many people said stuff to me that I was like, what? And then yeah. I had so many friends who disappeared and they were like, well, I didn't know what to say to you. It's like, that's good. Cause the only people who knew what to say have experienced this.
Yeah.
So
but don't disappear. Don't disappear. Like that's the worst thing you could do is disappear from someone. Just tell them, I'm sorry, I'm not good at this. I don't know what to say to you. I'm right. really sorry.
And just like be there with them.
Yeah.
Like, or, and like it's COVID. So I would say like half the population is respecting that there's a pandemic. You can just text and be like, hey, I'm thinking about you. Yeah. That's all you need to do. And it's a lot simpler than people think it is.
It is. It is. Yeah. I think Jewish people are really good at it. You know, people who are aware of the Jewish traditions, like my friend brought me food. She's like, Jewish people bring each other food.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. You know, so I think there are some groups that have some pretty good rituals and activities around death.
Yeah, absolutely. I think bringing food is good. I like to, people who listen to the podcast have heard me talk about this a bunch of times, but I like to send people blankets or candles.
Mm.
Like, I think that's really nice. And like, if like you live in a small space, like, and 10 people send you flowers, it's like so nice. But like, I live yeah. in a greenhouse now. So I like to do candles or blankets and just send food. And I think that what happens is there's, depending on who you are or whatever, I feel like people's like, I don't want to say patience and grace period also feels like the wrong word to use, but it's between like 1 and like 3, maybe 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then people are like, okay, you're back to normal now. And right. it's like, no, we have a new normal.
Yeah, it took me, you know, a year to really start to move forward, you know, and get over it. Time obviously helps a lot, but it has been about 3.5 years, almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years in the beginning of May. And I don't think about my mom that much. I really don't. I barely think about her.
Mm-hmm.
There are definitely moments that I'll have. Usually I don't get upset or anything. I'll just think of my mom and go, oh yeah, my mom, she used to exist. And it'll relate to something I'm doing in my life or mm-hmm. just thinking about in that moment. Maybe a song comes on that makes me think of her, or I might come across some photo or something like that. but I don't think about her a lot, and I don't think it would serve me to constantly think about her. There, it seems, well, everyone has a way of going through this stuff and dealing with it with some commonalities, but I feel like I don't think about my mom as much as other people would think about their parent who has passed away or their child who has passed away, something like that. I had to, early on, just decide to do my own thing and go on with my life. And that's kind of what I'm doing. It's just an extension, especially now that she's gone. I don't have that whole dimension. I don't have that noise going on in my life, mm-hmm. which is very freeing. I have all this space now to focus even more on myself. Mm-hmm. And having to do that really early on in my life has served me very well. There's been a lot of challenges, obviously, but I see that as a skill and a strength. And it's definitely been coming in handy because my dad is sick. And mm-hmm. my dad will, he's, well, just to be frank, you know, he probably has maybe a few years left or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this is giving me some good preparation in terms of how to think about and manage this kind of situation from a place of strength and experience, and remember to define and respect my boundaries for what is helpful for me. Mm-hmm. It might sound callous or self-centered, but again, it's a result of how my parents treated me as a kid and even as an adult. And I think it's okay to be focused on yourself. Again, so many people give up their lives and their time and their money and their energy to give people who have harmed them something that those people never gave to them mm-hmm. and never will be able to. And I just decided over all of these experiences and over time to put myself first.
And I think that that's really brave and speaks so much to your character. That's not an easy place to get to mentally. So I think that's like really amazing. And I admire that you've been able to do that because it's really hard.
Thanks. I don't think everyone gets it. Like I said, it can kind of come off as like, whoa, wow. But it really is, it's a complicated thing, but it makes total sense, right? It's just a matter of choice and really thinking through stuff. Again, the therapy has been really, really helpful to get perspective on, well, if you take a step back, here's what's actually gone on your entire life. Keep that in mind in your life today. Keep that in mind as you're moving forward and as you're dealing with these kind of situations, making a choice as to what to center your energy on, even if it means that you're doing less for someone who you still may care about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if this is of interest to you, if you have time or whatever, but I'm happy to talk about the practical side of some of this stuff. You know, my mom had like nothing set up in her will, and I don't have to go into here's how you do it, but more of the experience of having to confront an entire estate out of nowhere, having to do all of that stuff and take on this. It's like, my mom did one last piece of damage to me by leaving me this fucking mess to deal with, you know, sell the house, sell all of her stuff. It took a year, and it's just like, thanks. Thanks a lot. But, you know, I took on that responsibility because there was no one else to do that. And luckily my partner was super supportive in helping me kind of get things figured out, dealing with government bureaucracies and, you know, paying bills and all of that stuff. It is so important to get that stuff straightened out. And that was one of my to-do items in 2020. And I got it done. I got my will taken care of. I figured all of that stuff out. I know who's going to take care of my estate. I know who's getting what. I know where my money is going to go, where my stuff is going to go. And no one will just have to all of a sudden have to figure out that stuff if I happen to like go outside and get hit by a bus tomorrow.
And that's such a gift. So I appreciate you sharing this, because I've talked about this a lot, and you and I have talked about this, that like it's so important to do. And I like the way you phrased it, that just what you end up leaving people with if you don't take care of this is a mess. And it's so much harder, and people are grieving anyway. So like, yes, mm-hmm. it's painful to set up for like a few hours, but like, it's so worth it to do. I wrote out my will. I did it all. I have it printed out. I need to go get it notarized. I haven't done it yet. And I've been for a year, over a year, been telling people, Brooke, I'm so sorry about your debt. What can I do? Like, talk to your parents about where their will is. And I don't have one yet. That's signed.
Like, yeah.
But like, so you've inspired me. I'll go do that this week.
This is a preventive measure. You have all this stuff. You have your house, you have your shit, you have your whatever property. Even if you don't have property, you have things and stuff that will need to be dealt with, your online identity, your bills, whatever. And it's not nice to not prepare other people for how to do that, because it takes so much of an effort. And her dying and my experience with dealing all of that, somehow miraculously taking care of it within the span of a week, out in Michigan and being able to come back and do the rest from here. Yeah, I think that's the fair way to go. And I think the other thing, what I recommend to people is, while money is a taboo discussion topic, it is so important for people to have a copy of your will and to understand the structure of that, because it adds drama to relationships if you don't. Mm-hmm. I have had to ask my dad numerous times over the past year. I did my will before my dad did his will. I have had to push his ass to get his will done, and he finally did. And then something was missing, and I said, Dad, you need to address this in there. Well, okay, blah, blah, blah. So I think getting that set up, getting clear, and if you don't know the structure of someone's will, then you don't know how to structure your will. And it's all interconnected. Mm-hmm. And so just to think of it as a preventive measure, a gift, a final gift to that person. Hey, you have to deal with this stuff, but at least I'm helping you figure it out in a more efficient and easy way is so appreciated.
So appreciated. Oh my goodness. All right, let's end there. Thank okay. you so much.
I hope this was good. I feel like I didn't even talk about anything interesting.
No, I think it was really good. So thank you so much for being here today and for sharing all of this. I really appreciate your honesty and willing to share this that I think people go through and don't talk about. So thank you so much. Well, thank you, Amy. And thank you everyone for listening. You can find us online at thegriefcoach.co and on social at the_griefcoach. And please leave nice reviews on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people looking for this type of content be able to find it. Thank you.